What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I'm in Hell's Kitchen. I'm back in my hometown. Been here for a year, I think, as of this week actually. Down from the Upper West Side, which if you're not in New York, seems all very close, but it's a few miles away, a few kilometers away from each other. I had a great time in Brazil. Today I'm going to talk to you about how to fix your presentations. We'll talk about some student work from the Sweathead Strategy Accelerator, and I'll read you some responses to a post that I put up where I was asking people, like, is anyone enjoying working in advertising right now? TLDR on that, yes, there are, but I just attract a lot of angst, I think. Maybe it's because of how I put myself out there, but I don't know. In Brazil, I feel like I've talked with a lot of people who feel fortunate to work in the industry, but they're burnt out. Sometimes they worry about whether they're doing meaningful work, job volatility, not a lot of security. I think when you look at what's happening right now in the world, in the economy, it's hard to know whether it's just this year or this is how it's going to be for the next decade or the next few decades. I think that's one of the hardest things. We hear a lot of doublespeak. There are good signals and not good signals about the economy. I've caught up with a lot of strategists in the US, a couple of groups actually in the past few weeks, including a lovely group of comms planners down at Mother's Ruin in Soho last week, some of whom had recently lost jobs. And if that's you, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. You know, it's easy for me to say that, but these things do happen in cycles. You're going to work it out. You're a strategist. You're going to work it out. It might be painful for a little bit of time. And if you've got really challenging financial or sometimes health situations connected to your financial situation, as in sometimes in the US, you might have a job which you appreciate and you might earn okay money, but a big part of why you might have a job or a particular kind of job in a particular big place is because the healthcare situation or the insurance is better in a big place. But look, as long as you're not in like a dire situation financially or from a health point of view, you're going to be okay. You're going to come through. Try to stay active. A lot of you will probably want to withdraw, nurse your wounds, try to stay a little bit active, write, teach, talk, catch up with people. I'd be a little wary of things like, you're going to have 50 coffee meetings in 50 days, that kind of stuff. I find that a little bit weird, materialistic, obsessive, odd, but that can be useful just to generate some momentum, to get you into your body, to get you out of your head, to get you into conversations. That stuff can actually work. I'm a little bit cynical about it. We got lots of stuff coming up at Sweathead for the rest of the year. We had a very ambitious year. It's been interesting. It's been challenging. The stuff we got coming up is I'm teaching a 4-week strategy accelerator. You can find out details about that at sweathead.com. It starts in October. We have a comms planning masterclass with Media by Mothers, Maria Van Buskirk, in September 21. It's going to be awesome. Got quite a lot of interest in that. So come along to that if you're interested in learning about comms planning, which is not comms marketing, which is typically a phrase used around PR. Well, the word communications is typically and probably predominantly used in the agency world when it comes to public relations. And so there's been a little bit of confusion. People in the PR world who want to learn about communications, but they're thinking PR communications. Comms planning is typically a set of skills that would sit in an advertising agency or in a media agency. A comms planner to me is a creative mind that understands the media, knows how to mess with platforms, is a bit mischievous, a bit deviant, and works with the more hardcore numbers people that I would assume are media planners to make creative media selections that give the campaigns they're working on the best chance of getting people's attention. That's what that role is to me. I'm actually making a little comms planning course to share my point of view on that. That'll be on the website soon. We also have the Sweathead Do Together popping off November 8 and 9. It's 2 days, 12 to 3 p.m. Eastern time. That's New York time. The theme is irreplaceable. We're excited. We're just getting some speakers together about that. The year one, this is our third year. Year one was 2021. I think we gave ourselves 6 months, but we didn't do anything in between because we didn't want to have too many messages. And so we had this spike of early bird sales, and then it was really quiet through summer. Definitely a theme since the pandemic, probably a theme since forever, but my gosh. I've been talking to a lot of people, whether it's just through the internet, the tweets, or in real life, a lot of people who are new to the freelance life. August, woo! Oh yeah, yeah. If there's a Sunday scariest things, there's got to be like an August angst thing. To the point where I think in the future, July and August, and then January, February, I got to work out how to not be in New York. So next year, I'm thinking about doing a few weeks in Brazil. do a tour, and then I'm talking to a couple of people in Sri Lanka, talking to big social media platform about the Middle East in January. So perhaps I'm going to go to the Middle East and India and Sri Lanka in January, February. It's something that I'm thinking through. Because I just find, you know, I was going to say because I'm a workaholic. It's not because I'm a workaholic. I don't do crazy hours, but I do have a ruminating and obsessive mind. And sometimes I don't like the middle of winter, and sometimes I don't like the middle of summer, and I panic and I'm like, what's going on? What's going on? So I need things to be doing that distract me. But also when it's really, really hot, often you don't really want to work. So I don't know. I think I need to go to a different hemisphere. So yes, to do together, it's called Mission Irreplaceable. And what we've done is we're inviting a whole bunch of people that we know. There'll be over 12 speakers, 6 hours of online conference, about 30 minute sessions, hands-on exercises, and we'll give you 12 months of our Starter Mode membership. So far we have Derek Walker, you all know him, Rosie Jacob, you all know Rosie, Rob Estratinha, you know Rob, Vicky Ross, Heather Lefevre. We reached out to a whole bunch of people. What we're going to do is 50 equal split of 50% of revenue, not profit, which means I'm taking the risk. Probably not the year that you want to do this in, Mark. Probably not the year you want to do this in. But that's trying to work out the different models where people are getting paid equitably. But you know, we've got a team of about 8 to 10 that'll be working on putting this together. So the business needs to not lose money, preferably earn money. We'll be selling sponsorships. You can DM me or email me if you're interested in that. And what we're also doing is inviting the speakers to invite someone to talk with them or after them or before them. And the whole theme is like, what is going to make strategists in particular irreplaceable? So that's happening in November. There's also another masterclass with Tahab Race in October, October 18. Tahab, one of the most award-winning strategists in the world, will be doing something on the award-winning mindset, creative brief strategies that help you do really, really well. All right, let's get into some of the information. I know we've got a lot going on. We actually have a planning meeting tomorrow. We've got an open house or an open day on September, was it Thursday, September 7 for the Accelerator. You can find details about that either by DMing me or just probably DMing me or through our social posts. So today I want to talk about how to improve presentations. We'll talk about some student work, and then I'll share some answers to this question. You know, is anyone actually enjoying working in advertising right now? And I feel like I might as well start there. I was quite surprised. And like, my question was not trying to seek out negativity. I'm just aware that there's a lot of people doing it tough right now. And a lot of people get frustrated with the industry, especially as you get a little bit older. You do see these posts online where you can tell someone's just lashing out because they've lost a job or two jobs in a row, and it's like, rah, very angry, which I get. But for a lot of us, it's one of those industries that we fell into, and it's a rare industry because you can earn a salary, relative to the history of the world, it's not a bad salary. And if you're doing really well, it's a very good salary. But you can earn a salary, you can be around creative people, you can try to do creative work. If you're a strategist and you love finding stuff out, you love being a student, you can do that in this industry. There aren't many other industries like it, but it's under pressure. It's under margin pressure. It's under all kinds of, you know, clients are moving from big retainers to more project-based relationships. We're a decade into that, but it feels like it's speeding up, and in-housing is speeding up as well. But then people make these moves, or companies make these moves, and things don't quite click. You know, CEO or CMO is like, we should have an in-house team, but they don't know how to necessarily get the best out of that culture, because you're dealing with people who've used to kind of been, they've been used to running things in their own agencies often, and they get pulled into an in-house team, and it's like, you're kind of like an internal service provider in many places, and that can make people struggle. So I'll give a shout out to Jason Lonsdale, Chief Strategy Officer. So he says, yeah, he is enjoying working in advertising right now. He says this: I'm lucky enough to have assembled a wonderful team of strategists. Some days are harder than others, of course, but I'm enjoying it more than I have in years. Jiang Yang says, I still love every second of it. Our agency has gone integrated, but it means we get new challenges every day, which keeps us on our toes. Neville D says, I mean, yeah, the things that excited me about a great idea 15 years ago still do today. And I also get to be the senior member that I and many of my contemporaries needed, but didn't have when we were juniors. All of that means it's still something in which I find enjoyment every single day. That is a beautiful thing. As you move up a little into management positions, you get to possibly be the, or try to be it's hard. But try to be the manager or the boss that you didn't have growing up or that you loved when you were coming up in the industry. Test the hippie. I genuinely love advertising, but at times I question myself who I am outside the agency life bubble. All of us know that work doesn't end in four corners of an office or a work for home setup. It's endless ideation, inspiration, and thinking. Agency life consumes you, and sometimes you attach a whole identity to it. Is it worth it in the long run? I don't know. Oh, here's Laurel Liu. I love this one as well. This will be the last one that I read out. If you want to see these answers, there's, I don't know, a few hundred on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn on my personal accounts. Laurel, I believe, is, let me just double check, I believe he's still at EA, right? Yeah. While there are really, really challenging things about every job in marketing / advertising, I feel pretty damn lucky to work with people I like on work that is values aligned for me. Especially in this cultural, political moment, being able to use my work and creativity to spotlight trans / NB artists and normalize gender non-conforming characters, that feels pretty powerful and special, if I'm being honest. It's awesome. It's awesome. I love it when people love where they work. I've seen it a few times. It's awesome. So, interesting. How are we going to reflect on the past few years in a decade? And I know that if you're listening to this, you're very lucky in the world. For me to be doing this, I'm very lucky in the world. But it's been stressful. It's been so stressful. And like, I came through the dot-com crash in like 99-2000, having seen parents go through recessions in the 1990s. And I had parents going to collect, you know, maybe $50 a week, $50 a month. I don't even know what the number was. I don't want to be dramatic. And one of them found it very difficult to talk about. Unemployment checks we're talking about here. Being awkward. Why am I being awkward? But yeah, like it's really, really, really big hit to the ego, and difficult just from how do you feed family and do all that sort of stuff. So I've seen it. And then, yeah, I went through the dot-com thing 2008. I remember seeing offices empty out, clients' offices empty out. We nearly had zero money. We went to France for a wedding with a 6-month-old and a 2.5-year-old. And we didn't really have money to go, but we'd committed. We went, and then we didn't have money. We slept in the airport because we couldn't afford a hotel. Hotel was probably like $150, $200. I'm like, I'm just going to sleep in the airport with babies. That was the night Obama got voted in, for what it's worth. Keep your politics to yourself. I'm joking. I'm just joking. So, I don't know. I can tell you that running the business that I run, it's beautiful. And all you can do when you run your own business is launch the next thing, do the next thing. We were probably a little aggressive with our programming this year. Had a lot of different stuff. And then we've had this challenging website that I think we've got it into, the team has got it into a better and more stable place. Now thinking about 2024, you know, what is Sweathead? We've got memberships, we've got events, we've got me teaching, we've got guest teachers. What do people actually want from us? If you've got opinions, let us know. But it's not easy out there. Not easy out there. So before I get into the presentation stuff, let me share some student work. And if you're interested in this, the team, the Sweathead team, has dropped a 70-page document of 15 examples of student work from the Sweathead Strategy Accelerator. I think the one coming up is number five in public, but I've done a couple for companies as well. It's a 4-week program. Excuse me, I just burped. I hope that didn't come through on the microphone. It's a Labor Day weekend here, by the way, and of course I'm not working. Of course I had meetings scheduled. I didn't even think about it. I never know when the holidays are in the US. I never know. In Australia, kind of new. People talked about it here. I'm like, Anyway, so I thought after I've got a few meetings today, and I thought, let me just quickly record a podcast. So the Sweathead Strategy Accelerator, we've done four of them. This will be number five. And we've got 4 weeks, about 8 classes. You work on a project. We have really, really well edited, I believe, videos that are kind of YouTube worthy, but they're not on YouTube. They're not anywhere other than in the accelerator program. And we have people from all kind of backgrounds, walks of life. We have people a few years in and who are full-time strategists. We have people who are 20 years, 30 years in, who are brand consultants or even CCOs. Sometimes CSOs, sometimes running agencies. I feel like one of the main questions I get is, you know, what level is your training? It's like, I don't know. because I have taught thousands of people and I've seen a lot of people in the rooms and I've seen a lot of situations where very senior people might position me to their people as, yeah, it's all about fundamentals. And then 30 minutes in, they're sitting at the back taking notes and getting involved. So it is definitely about the fundamentals, but I don't know. I don't really like thinking about it as far as levels. I do think it's useful to have a few years into the industry to get the most out of it. So one of the briefs that we've set, and we might set this one again, is for a drug called naltrexone. When was it? A couple of accelerators ago, we found a lot of people doing this. I was quite surprised. Naltrexone, the way that I understand it, it has an off-label benefit, which is to potentially reduce alcohol cravings and binge drinking. So I think it's this underground drug that's popping up. I mean, it's not an underground drug. What am I saying? You get it for prescription. It's totally fine. I think it usually deals with, is it blood pressure? But it can reduce cravings and binge drinking. Peter M. Gay, this is his response. So the question is, how do you sell naltrexone to someone who realizes they drink too much but doesn't see themselves as an alcoholic? So we'll run you through the 4 points, which is problem, insight, advantage, strategy. We keep in mind a business issue. We keep in mind an audience. So the problem, as Peter has stated it, is this. Men stay on the binge drinking merry-go-round because asking for a beer is easier than asking for help. Insight. Here's the thing about easy. No one ever got stronger with easy. Advantage. Getting stronger just gets easier with naltrexone, a new medical solution to curb your alcohol cravings. Strategy. It's last call on heart. Just ask for naltrexone and get your life back on track. So that strategy statement's written kind of as a piece of copy, really. But you can see this theme emerging around easy and hard, hard decisions, asking for help, what's easy, what's hard. And I guess the strategy is to show, yeah, it's last call on hard. So that's, there's a pun in there. I've talked about this with Peter. There's a pun in there. And sometimes, because last call in a bar, just for those of you who are not familiar with bar culture. Did that need explaining? It probably didn't. But it's last call on hard. There's a pun there. Okay. But I can see where this is going. And then what everybody does is they write a strategy story, at least one. A strategy story is a one-page argument which takes your 4 points and gets you to write it somewhere tighter. And then between the 4 points and your one-page strategy story, you basically have the setup for your presentation. All right, Karen O'Malley, this is her response to the naltrexone brief. She focused on women. Women who binge drink will take blackout over stressed out. That's the problem. The reason that women, these women, this is broad, okay, and I know we're using broad gender-based terms which can trigger people, but it's just an exercise. Insight, but here's the thing about blacking out. It's where fun tips into fear. Advantage, naltrexone lets you go from scary blackout to fun night out. Strategy will show that a night out with naltrexone is much better stress relief than blacking out with the boys. So that's what I like about that, especially as far as the healthcare space goes, is it's very honest, it's very true. And I would say, like, I worked at McCann in Sydney and I worked on a lot of different brands, including Pfizer brands and healthcare brands, but often touch 15 to 20 brands in a year. Okay, it's one of I don't know if it's still like that, but I think that's one of the advantages of working in a smaller market with smaller teams. You get to touch a lot of different stuff, learn a lot about a lot. This kind of brief, the way that she's written it, or the strategy, it's very honest, it's very confessional, and I would expect that kind of work in Australia. I think it'd be hard to get that through in the US. The US is much more conservative, and in the healthcare space, it's more robotic. And it's hard. It's weird because the healthcare space, as far as advertising and marketing goes, it can attract people who are really passionate about health and wellness. But it can also attract people who just want a safe job and maybe a lucrative job without having to do great, great work. Sorry, it's just true. You know it. Look at the standard of work. Look at it. I'm not lying. And also, I've spoken to a lot of people who made these decisions, and they tell me why. You know, in the pandemic, I was talking to people who had lost jobs, and like, I think I need to work in the healthcare space because it's growing. You know, I'll get a better sense of security there. But what Karen's written here, I can see that in Australia more than I could in the US. But if you can get that kind of, that tone of thinking through in the US, I'd love to know. We might actually be doing interviews with some of these people, so you might hear directly from their voices. Here's one from Victoria Gates Fleming. She's at day one. This brief was for Party City. Party City is like a massive Toys R Us, but it sells party goods. And Victoria responded to this brief. I guess this is 2021. So 2 years ago when... Was it 2021? So we were locking down again. And so one of the briefs was, how do you get people to go to Party City to buy party goods, to throw parties, when people are like, nah, you shouldn't throw parties? Problem. It takes a lot more to get us off the couch and out of our sweatpants these days. Insight. People have felt nothing for so long. They're nervous about partying. Won't feel as good as they hoped. Even worse, what if I feel nothing? I felt that too. I remember catching up with a mate a few times, probably 6 to 12 months, and we'd go out, go to the pub or something. I'm like, I didn't feel anything. Is it just me? Advantage, Party City stirs the senses and can set the mood for any party. Strategies show that Party City can help you feel something again. It's cute. It's nice and tight. You know, it's essentially saying you might be a little bit numb right now. And there was a lot written about that. I've forgotten the word. I think it begins with a harmonia or something. It's like an old word which is adjacent to depression, but basically means you don't feel anything. You're feeling a bit numb. And this strategy is very gentle, very delicate, very focused in on that to say, hey, feel something again. It's not saying, hey, you got to throw a massive party. It's like, feel something again. You can throw a little party. So I like it. I like it. So there you go. If you're interested in accessing reading the student work, check the show notes because I'll put a link to 70 pages of student work there. Let's talk about you and your presentation. So I've done a few things lately. I've been trying a couple of different formats on the reels. One is I just made a video from my phone of my laptop with Keynote open, and I showed about 10 slides talking through presentations. I wrote a really long article. I should probably try to turn this into a book. I don't know if it's book worthy. A few years ago for QZ Quartz, about how to write presentations that make a point. They split it up into about four. I believe the main one or the set of them were like the most read, as at least from guest contributors that month. And it was fun because I still remember sitting down to write it. I remember where I was. I remember what I wanted to achieve. But I'd been toying with these little drawings that some of you might have seen. And I thought, you know what? From now on, I want to use these drawings anytime I write for someone else, which I've not done since because I just stopped writing for other people until this year. And then I've not done the drawings. I really just wanted to generate my own content, my own voice, and really find out, you know, where I was. But QZ, this must have been about five or six years ago. The way that I wrote this and the way that this came together, and I'm saying this just because some of you want to write more, maybe you want to write a book, maybe you want to publish more on LinkedIn, etc., is I was working with an agency, the 88, with Sophie Hauptführer and a bunch of awesome people. And I was looking at a pitch they were working on, and I said, look, let's go through this, but I'm going to take notes, and I just want to see how I explain things to you. Which is kind of a meta thing to do, to be in an interaction, but then be taking notes about yourself in that interaction. And I think in that moment, I think it was either there or I'd been playing with this theme anyway, I drew two bad drawings. One was an information monster, and I knew what the concept was. It was like a drawer of index cards in the library, old school, with just something monster-like. So it's like Viking horns. And what I wanted to communicate with that drawing, it's not good, it's just me mucking around, probably took me 30 seconds. what I wanted to communicate is that a bad presentation can feel like you're trawling through these index cards as the observer, the audience, the reader of that presentation. And I was like, well, what's the opposite of an information monster? And so I called it a story rainbow. And I drew a rainbow, and I don't know, it's a story rainbow, very simple. And in this interaction, I've told this story a couple of times, and I don't know if this, one of the strategists is listening to this or not, but it was really interesting because I didn't know, first of all, that it was going to be so well received, because I wanted to write it in a little bit of a literary way. I don't know if I nailed it, but I just don't like standard boring business writing. I find it boring. So I tried to have like alliteration, and I tried to describe small moments, like you're in a meeting and your jaw juts and just little things like that, plus these two drawings. And they said yes. So yeah, it was well read. But also in this meeting, I know I've told this story a few times, very briefly though, someone took a photo of the story rainbow and got it as a tattoo on their leg. And the reason that I love that story is obviously that's very personal, and I appreciate that my little drawing made it onto somebody's body. But when you're making things, you just don't know what is going to happen. You just don't know. Now, the flip side of that is you could make a lot of stuff for years and maybe you feel like nothing happens, and then you might become resentful. But I don't know. It's kind of cool. So let's talk about how to improve your presentations. What I see a lot of is just, I don't know. I get bored really quickly these days. And if you're like two or three slides in and you're just saying stuff I've heard before, or I can tell that the presentations, words have just been dumped into it, my brain will be just like, I don't want this. I don't want this. So like, yep, hurry up. Life's too short. And so what's happening out there is a lot of people are just reporting information in these presentations. They're not really forming opinions, or if they do, they're hiding behind these big words that don't really mean anything. Not using visuals very often. But you know what? You're probably going to have worked with, or you are the person who's just brilliant at presentations. Everything's funny. You've got animated GIFs. You've got good stories. There's an opening and a closing. There's a structure to it. It's intriguing. It's a piece of entertainment. And that's what I encourage you to do, you know, especially if you're a little bit bored at work. If you can insist on everything that you're doing being an opportunity for you to be creative, every email you send, every meeting you host, every presentation that you do, every document that you write, every interview that you do, there can be an element of creativity there that can prevent you from being robotic. And then it just becomes kind of like a lifestyle, a way of life. And then if you keep behaving like that for years and years and years, you become quite a, maybe not a different person, but a more amplified person. And you'll have tried a lot of different things. You might have a lot of ideas that you can launch for yourself. So let's just generally talk about a couple of tips on how to improve your presentations. One is, think about the information monster experience, bullet point after bullet point, statistic after statistic, all the research that I've done, teacher. Look, I've got 20 slides of it. Don't care, put it in the appendix. Tell me your story, what's the point? So we want to shift from an information monster to a story, or a rainbow. A story rainbow, that's what I was calling it. A story rainbow is more seductive. If you're in very logic, hardened environments, this will feel very risky. So good luck with that. There are various ways to structure a presentation. Traditionally, people talk about a three-act story structure, although increasingly people do talk about a four-act story structure. That's partly because in the screenwriting world, the second act is often, well, much longer. I was going to say twice as long, but much longer than act one or act two. So there's an argument that really there are four acts in a lot of screenwriting. But if you're going to be writing a presentation for a pitch or for a client this week, I'll give you eight simple ways to structure this thing. One is some kind of hook. Grab my attention from the very start. I personally believe, unless I'm with fussy people who want to dilute our thinking, if we're using slides, and that's one of your key decisions, are you using slides? I want each slide to work hard and to make a point, or it gets deleted. So for example, the first slide, I'm not a fan of digital pitch response, blah blah blah. Give it a title. You know, how to hold hostage the minds of blah 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 blah. Make it beautiful, right? Because someone might print this thing out, put it on a desk, someone's walking by and they're like, oh, what's that? Whereas if you just dry on that very first slide, I don't know, it's a bit of a letdown. I feel like it's very lazy. So either on that slide or the next slide, you want some kind of hook. I'd often start with a problem. Again, not all cultures can handle that. I might not use the word problem. I might use the word issue. It depends on who I'm working with, but I might have one big word up on the slide or a phrase with an image or just an image and go, look, this is where we're starting today. This is the problem that we need to solve. And I'll sit on that a little bit. I might have a few slides after it that basically argue, I find that word is a bit awkward in our work, that argue for the problem. We're arguing for the problem. We got to sell the problem so that we can sell our solution to the problem. But I want some kind of hook, which could be the problem. It could be an incredible quote from an interview that you did. Maybe it's from a stakeholder, but you got to grab our attention. And that's basically like the first line on a LinkedIn post. How are you going to grab our attention? And then sit there a little bit. And you can pause. You can change the cadence. You could tell a story really, really quickly and then just pause and say, so this is what we need to solve today. Or if we solve this, here's what we can do. The following few slides will be the situation. And you might use something like the 4 C's or 6 C's framework. Consumer truth, cultural truth, category or competitive truth, or competitor truth, company truth. We can talk about conscious inclusion, which are the groups of people that you want to consciously include in your communication. And there could also be a context or channel truth. So we get you to 6, 6.5. And you can use that structure to get through the situation as you see it. You don't need too many frameworks here. I think you just use one up front. I don't think you need to show a SWOT. You don't need to show all the other frameworks that people use. Some marketing academics make fun of SWOTs. So they're just tools. I don't know why you'd make fun of it. But you have some kind of hook, and then you're making your argument for either the problem or the opportunity that you've introduced in the next 5 to 10 slides, if you're using slides, because you don't have to. I've drawn slides on pieces of paper, so they're not really slides, but I've drawn my presentation on pieces of paper in front of one client. Then the CEO at the time, he was there, he was like, okay, let's do it. Let's see how you roll, which is kind of cool. After the situation, so maybe it's 10, then I would typically state the challenge. Therefore, this is what we need to do. Or when I'm using words like problem and challenge, to me, they're actually quite specific because of how I would write them. To me, a problem would be stated in a sentence, just like the ones you heard earlier from the student work. A challenge statement to me is more of like, how can we do blah, 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 blah. So how do we get people to see, how do we get people who are drinking too much to see naltrexone as something that won't kind of accuse them of being an alcoholic, but will help them just calm their drinking down a little bit? That was too many words, but that's what happens when you think aloud. Okay, so that's act one, hook, situation, challenge. Around that point, I would have some kind of strategy framework, 4 C's, 4 points, whatever it is, and I would pause on it. This is called signposting. So I use numbers a lot. I use a framework very gently. And I just want to make sure people's brains get to absorb it a little bit, because there's quite a lot of information already. Start of act two, our idea. And you want the idea to have a name and to be explained in a sentence. If you use manifestos, if you use hashtags, if you use idea statements, great. What I said was kind of an idea statement, but you need a very clear name and a clear explanation. Two examples that I use all the time. Earth hour idea, we're gonna get the world to turn its lights off for an hour. McDonald's, McDonald's name it burger, we're gonna get Australia to name a new burger. You wanna land that really, really clearly. Manifestos can be too slippery. Sometimes it's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. It's corporate poetry, it's not good. A good manifesto is amazing, but most are not. And then often you get someone will be like, oh, I've got a hashtag, still not an idea, mate. And then a slide which sort of tells you how to feel about the idea versus telling you what the idea is. That's a trick that you see quite often. So, you know, people are going to love this yoga campaign because it's going to make them remember how simple yoga is. Well, it's like, well, what's the idea? Is the idea something to do with simple or simplicity? Because if it is, that's not enough. That's not an idea yet. But what's the idea? And if you don't have one, people won't know how to grasp onto it in the presentation, and it will just travel in a very messy way across all the other agencies and in-house teams and through the client organization. Then you get to your tactics, obviously, and your rollout plan, which could be a comms plan. Maybe it's a three-act comms plan. There are various ways to structure a comms plan. I won't go into that now. What I personally like is when you're choosing media channels that connect with the theme in the idea / strategy, and to emphasize those media channels, knowing that you're going to be probably spending the bulk of your money on something that's programmatic anyway. Then, so that basically takes you through act two. Act one is the situation and the situation or the current routine right now, and it breaks. So in storytelling, act one is like the current routine breaks, then you get act two. Act two is what we're going to do that's different. And then act three, just from a really simplistic point of view, could be logistics and who's working on it, how much is it going to cost, and then some kind of ending story. All very straightforward. Okay, so that would be the third act. Some of the key issues that I see with presentations, then I'll talk to you about openings and endings of presentations. Some of the key issues with presentations are these. There's no central theme, just bouncing everywhere. And a way to cure this is, especially with the first 10 to 20 slides, is there a word or two that's appearing a lot? Just be stubborn. Be really, really stubborn. And you can build all of those slides and the proof points are around that. So for example, with Victoria Gates Fleming's example, show that Party City can help you feel something again. The current situation is people aren't feeling much. So each slide, I would tell that story. You know, slide two, here's what I learned from the psychologist. Slide three, we interviewed 20 people. Slide four, we interviewed 3 people who were at Party City for the first time in a year. Slide five, I'm going to forget what number I'm at. We interview people who work at Party City, so on and so forth, right? But each of those slides would support the theme that people aren't feeling very much right now or don't know what to feel. One of those, for example. Another key issue with presentation is a lot of useless information. If it's not supporting your argument or moving your story forward, just put it in the appendix. And the way you navigate that, if you've got fussy colleagues, is you just say, I'm going to tell a story here. I'm going to get into the idea quickly because that's what we're selling, right? All the research we did, that's in the back. Or we can have another meeting about it. But let's try to get into the idea because that's what they're going to buy from us. Another key issue with presentations is telling the audience what they already know. And if you're a bit young and in a slightly arrogant agency, that can go down really badly. You know, so if you're saying things that you think the client or whoever it is knows, then you might say, look, there's 5 things that we've come across that you probably know, and that there's these 5 things. But there's this one thing we found that might be new to all of us, right? Because otherwise it can be a little bit of a battle of egos. And if you trigger their ego, I believe they're less likely to be listening to you. Another issue with presentations, lack of a show. Treat it as entertainment. I know a lot of you are working from home right now. I don't know how you do it. I'm joking. I do it a bit, although I move around cafes and gyms in New York. Put on a show. It doesn't have to be corny unless you want to be corny. And if you're going to be corny, have fun with it. Tell stories. Make unusual connections. You'll be remembered. Another and maybe final key issue with presentations, too many authors. Presentations, they really need one voice, one authorial voice. You can tell when there's been 20 people hovering, and it triggers a bit of PTSD in me, some of this stuff, when I think about the times when you're under stress and you just got people who don't really add a lot and they're fussing and they're using phrases like, oh, my concern is, or they're moving slides around before you go in and present, and then you're presenting, you're like, hang on, where's that slide that I thought was next? That happened to me a couple of times in my mid to late 20s, but never again. Probably one or two more times, actually, when I was reporting into presidents and CEOs, where maybe that happened. It never makes a difference. It's just that person's being fussy. It rarely makes a difference. 99.9% does not make a difference. Now, as far as opening and ending, because when you start to dig into screenwriting or quote-unquote storytelling, which I know is one of those words that makes a lot of us roll our eyes, people will often say, well, a good story needs a beginning, middle, and an end. And you're like, okay, what does that even mean? So there's a couple of concepts that I think are useful to help navigate this. One is called follow through. Follow through is when you introduce a thing, a theme, a person, a color, anything at the start, and then you might drop it in throughout, but at the very end of your presentation, you bring it back. So in my book, I talk a lot about Andrea Pirlo and Inigo Montoya. Andrea Pirlo, the Italian footballer, Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride. I didn't really bring them through the book, and I didn't really end with them, but if I was to stay true to my own instincts next time, it was a long book. I got tired writing it. I loved it, but I was like, oh, I could write this better. I would probably follow through with those characters, drop them in a few more times. Callbacks, that's what that is called, a callback, when you call someone or something back through the story, but I would follow through with them. Another concept, kind of connected, often very connected, is the concept of reversing. So you might start with an opening story, and that story could be an anecdote from your research, an anecdote from history, an anecdote from your own life. Someone asked me when I posted about this, you know, where do you find the stories? It's like, well, you just pay attention, and then you try to force an interesting connection. So you could start with a story about someone you interviewed. You went to their home and you opened their fridge, and here's what you smelled, and here's what it looked like, and they said this, and then this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and that's when you realize, boom. That could be how you open, better, but that could be how you open. Then you go through the structure that I mentioned earlier. And then at the very end, you might call back that kitchen. And you might end by saying, you know what? Let's get back to that kitchen right now. And if we're successful, here's what that kitchen looks like. You can make it more interesting than what I just came up with, but that's an example of bringing a concept through and potentially reversing it, because you would show that kitchen as probably being the quote-unquote opposite from starting point. Okay, so there are a few techniques that you can play with. And I think at the heart of this is just resisting having a ton of information. And even now I work with companies, and every now and then I'll be working and I can feel that someone's anxious because we need more information, and we never do. We need better ideas usually, or better strategy, better briefs, better comms plans. We don't usually need a lot more information. But people who fuss with information, like, it's just a good way to make everyone feel insecure and like you're in control. So I hope you don't do that. But it's definitely done out there. All right, let's leave it there. I'm going to try a bunch of these sort of solo episodes. I'll get back to doing some interviews soon. But I've got a bunch of trips coming up. So I don't know if you're listening to this from any of these countries, but I'll be in Batumi, Georgia, mid-September. And then I'm going to Bulgaria for a day or two, in Turkey for a brief time. And then we have Peru in October. And there might be a couple of other places. Hope you're doing okay out there. I know it's a little bit of a weird time. But hopefully now that we're through August in the Northern Hemisphere, it's back to school week at the very least in New York. The US is different. Some places have probably been back to school for longer, but hopefully business will click in a little bit. So I know a lot of people have been waiting to hear from companies about freelance work or getting hired or all kinds of stuff. So anyway, hope you're doing okay out there. See you next time. Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.